Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives, written by Jeff Schmidt in the year 2000. The first chapter, Timid Professionals. No two people are allowed to read the same thing, I said above the noise, gesturing toward the other passengers on the crowded subway car. My out-of-town visitor glanced around the clattering train. Indeed, the commuters hurtling toward their jobs in Manhattan's office buildings, restaurants, shops, and other workplaces were reading such a wide variety of material that my joke about held up. That typical weekday morning found writers engrossed in all kinds of magazines, paperback books, the Daily News, the Post, the Times, office documents, a software instruction book, and yes, the Bible. Those who weren't reading were listening to headphones, talking to others, or apparently just thinking. Seeing this every day on the subway set me up for a surprise one morning when I went to catch a suburban commuter train to Manhattan. I'd stayed overnight in Westchester County, an upscale New York City suburb where many executives and professionals live. I would be riding into the city with lawyers headed for big corporate law firms, financial analysts going to investment banks, editors bound for publishing conglomerates, as well as accountants, journalists, doctors, architects, engineers, public relations specialists, and a host of other professionals. Boarding the train felt something like entering a library. There were no conversations, even though nearly all of the seats were occupied. Almost everyone was reading, but the dozens of passengers were reading only two things, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. I could have formulated another joke about allowed reading matter, but the scene was too spooky, like the aftermath of an invasion of the body snatchers. Everyone dressed the same, in suits, sitting silently in neat rows and columns, each holding up a large newspaper, absorbing the same information. A herd of independent minds? Something seemed very wrong with this picture. It was obvious that when the subway riders and the suburban train riders converged at the workplace, the people who showed the greatest diversity in their dress, behavior, and thought, the non-professionals, would be asked to do the least creative work, while the most regimented people would be assigned the creative tasks. This seemed just the opposite of what one might expect, and even more disturbingly, it indicated that people who do creative work are not necessarily independent thinkers. Evidence that professionals are not independent thinkers has been around for a long time but has generally been ignored, in part because people don't know how to make sense of it. The Vietnam War produced some revealing examples which are worth looking back at. On January 12, 1971, the federal government indicted Philip Berrigan and other East Coast anti-war activists on felony charges of plotting to impede the Vietnam War through violent action. The activists' agenda supposedly included blowing up underground heating pipes in Washington to shut down government buildings, kidnapping presidential advisor Henry Kissinger to ransom him for concessions on the war, and raiding draft boards to destroy records and slow down the draft. The Justice Department prosecutors chose to hold the conspiracy trial in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, a conservative area where a randomly chosen jury would be heavily against the defendants. However, before the jury was selected at what came to be known as the Harrisburg 7 trial, a group of left-leaning social scientists supporting the defendants interviewed a large number of registered voters in the area to try to figure out how to get a sympathetic jury there. They discovered, among other things, that college-educated people were more likely than others to be conservative and to trust the government. Thus, in court, during the 3 weeks that it took to examine 465 potential jurors and pick a panel of 12, lawyers for the defense quietly favored skilled blue-collar workers and white-collar workers without a lot of formal education. Non-professionals, although the sociologists and lawyers apparently never used that term. The lawyers were uneasy doing this, however, because it went against their intuition. The notion of close-minded hard hats and open-minded intellectuals is widespread and is reinforced by mass media characters like loading dock worker Archie Bunker and his college student son-in-law, Pinko Mike. In fact, All in the Family made its television debut the very day of the Harrisburg indictments, 12th of January, 1971. By the time the trial and jury selection started, it had been on the air for a year. Ignoring these false stereotypes paid off. The government put on a month-long $2 million extravaganza featuring 64 witnesses, including 21 FBI agents and 9 police officers. The defense called no one to the witness stand. After 7 days of deliberation, the jury was not able to reach a unanimous decision, and the judge declared a mistrial. But with 10 of the 12 carefully selected jurors arguing for a not guilty verdict, the government dropped the case. Blue-collar skeptics? Loyal intellectuals? Was the Harrisburg survey a regional fluke? Look at what the nationwide polls showed at the time. On February 15, 1970, the New York Times reported the results of a Gallup poll on the war in Vietnam. Gallup had found that the number of people in sharp disagreement with the government over the war had increased but still constituted a minority. While this increase in opposition was important news, what was particularly intriguing were the data on the opinions of subgroups of the population. The numbers announced with striking clarity that those with the most schooling were the most reluctant to criticize the government's stand in Vietnam. There was a simple correlation, although only in part a cause and effect relationship. The further people had gone before leaving school, the less likely they were to break with the government over the war. During the war in Vietnam, nearly everyone seemed to have one or another gripe about the U.S. government's efforts, but few took positions that dissented fundamentally from the government's goals. Some said they were for negotiation, some said they were for an end to the bombing, and some simply said they were for peace. Gallup's survey cut to the bottom line by posing what was always the most incisive question on the war. It asked people whether they would favor or oppose the immediate withdrawal of all U.S. troops from Vietnam. Age didn't affect the answers much. The ratio of those in favor to those opposed was about the same for young adults as it was for older people, but dramatic differences appeared according to formal education. Those with college educations opposed immediate withdrawal by more than 2-1, whereas those not formally schooled beyond the elementary grades were evenly divided on the question, and high school graduates were in between. Polls taken earlier and later in the Vietnam War, and polls taken during other wars, Korea for example, show the same correlation with formal education. Gallup was not the only one to find this connection between attitude and formal education. In a study entitled, A Degree and What Else? Correlates and Consequences of a College Education, sponsored by the Carnegie Commission on Higher Education, researchers found college graduates to be more supportive or hawkish than the rest of the population. Even in 1968, a year of rising anti-war sentiment and militant actions against the war, people who had been to college remained less likely than others to criticize the U.S. intervention in Vietnam, the Carnegie study found. People's reluctance to criticize the war was not simply the result of their careful analysis of an isolated issue. Rather, the position people took on the war followed almost mechanically from their overall political outlook, although some had their overall political outlook radicalized by what they experienced when they acted to do something about the war. With Americans being killed every day, Almost everything one said about the U.S. intervention in Vietnam was heard as a statement on the U.S. political, economic, and social system itself, and rightly so. Thus, a narrow statement against the war could elicit a broad response, such as, "If you don't like it here, go to Russia." Few now seem to remember that throughout most of the war, those who called for immediate withdrawal of all U.S. troops were seen as radicals, as critics of a lot more than the war. This explains in part the disparity between opposition and activism, why many opponents of the war didn't speak out publicly. More students than workers were anti-war activists, even though workers who had anti-war sentiments far outnumbered students of all persuasions. Workers organizing publicly to get the United States out of Vietnam risked a lot more, namely their jobs, because their employers were likely to see them as radicals and therefore a threat to the tranquility of the local workforce. The correlation between attitude and formal education is important for a book about professionals, because professionals typically have large amounts of schooling. Indeed, people in Gallup's occupational category, professional and business workers, have attitudes similar to those of people in the top education category. Unfortunately, Gallup has no category for professionals alone. The relatively uncritical stand of professionals on the issue of war is just the tip of the iceberg, for it is on the job that professionals have the greatest number of opportunities to display their ideological caution. Anyone who has ever had a job that involved interacting with professionals, or who has had to deal with doctors, lawyers, bankers, or the like, has surely encountered individuals with what we might call the professional attitude. Confident and assertive individuals who exude the feeling that they are very much at home playing by the rules, and that they have no pressing need to question the social structure in which they do their work. In many individuals, such identification with the system shows up in the negative. Their confidence immediately melts into fear at any suggestion of not playing by the system's rules. By the system, I mean the hierarchical organization of production, the system of bosses and employees, and the social, economic, and political practices that go along with it. Here and throughout the book, my emphasis is on the hierarchical structure. The system may be read as the hierarchy. And in fewer but more memorable individuals, this conservatism takes the form of elitism or pompousness, seemingly critical positions that cover for personal insecurity but involve no risk, because they complement the system by implying that it is too egalitarian, too democratic. Whether you are a professional or a non-professional, you encounter the professional attitude most frequently at work and on matters of work, not only because it is in the workplace that you are most often thrust into contact with professionals, but also because it is on the job that professionals are most sure to act like professionals. Most importantly, it is at work that the attitude of professionals has its greatest impact, both on you as an individual and on society as a whole. Whether a given professional designs buildings, writes newspaper articles, teaches courses, or develops investment strategies, she makes important decisions that affect many people. Outside of work, however, the professional's attitude has relatively little effect on society, unless the professional makes a deliberate effort to the contrary. For example, if you were given the power to dictate the outlook that governs the day-in, day-out decision-making of a professional at work, and I were given the power to dictate the outlook that governs what that professional does inside the voting booth every 4 years, then your power to shape society would be vastly greater than mine. It is worth pausing here to explain exactly what I mean by society. I use the word not to refer to the collection of individuals who happen to live within the national boundaries, but to denote the set of relationships among them. Relationships are indicated by such words as supervisor, employer, capitalist, union member, friend, boss, colleague, representative, housewife, homeboy, chairperson, organization member, and so on. Without relationships, there is no society. So when I talk about the power to shape society, I mean the power to affect the nature of these relationships. Something's social significance is its power to change society, its effect on the relationships among people or among classes of people. Does it strengthen or weaken one group relative to another? Public opinion pollsters report that professionals are more liberal than non-professionals on many social issues, such as civil liberties, personal morality, and cultural issues. Liberal professionals smugly conclude from this that they are a force for social progress, and that non-professionals are a conservative force in society. But the polls do not justify such a conclusion for two reasons. First of all, although professionals may be liberal on this or that question of the day, they tend to be very conservative on a long-standing issue of much greater importance to society, democracy. Discuss politics with a liberal professional, and you will not hear a word in favor of a more democratic distribution of power in society, perhaps because, in the professional's view, ignorant non-professionals make up a large majority of the population. Even the most liberal professionals tend toward authoritarianism in their social vision. The second reason the polls don't demonstrate that professionals are a more progressive force in society than non-professionals is that the surveys focus on broad social questions and not on attitudes in the workplace, where both professionals and non-professionals exert their greatest influence on society. The non-professional who is conservative off the job is often not at all conservative on workplace issues, and therefore is not necessarily a net conservative force in society. Similarly, the professional who is liberal off the job is often very conservative on work issues, and therefore is a net conservative force in society. Indeed, there is an enormous gap between the opinions of professionals and their professional opinions, the opinions that guide their work. When their opinions count, most professionals are conservative. Thus, the engineer who believes that corruption is common among politicians in the United States freely offers that opinion. The political scientist, however, fears being quoted as saying any such thing, even though few people would find it shocking. Ask the nuclear engineer whether the nuclear industry influences reactor safety estimates, something that has long been obvious even to non-experts, and you may get a lecture on the objectivity of mathematical calculations. And the liberal doctor who offers a cocktail party opinion against authoritarian police practices? Go to that doctor's office with a medical problem and see her lean toward the traditional authoritarian doctor-patient relationship. Professionals are liberal on distant social issues, issues over which they have no authority at work and no influence outside of work. Note that developments that raise doubt about the social or economic system itself are never distant issues, even when they are geographically distant and are not direct issues at work. As we saw, the Vietnam War, which involved the states forcing people to make the highest possible sacrifice for debatable reasons, was such a crisis of legitimacy for the system. Such national crises and other anxiety-producing situations or events are immediate issues and tend to elicit from professionals the same politically timid outlook that guides their work. Not surprisingly, while professionals are tolerant of distant social criticism, they have little tolerance for anyone who tries to provoke a debate about the politics that guides their own work. Noam Chomsky, a Massachusetts Institute of Technology professor and an outspoken critic of the state and the intellectuals who serve it, sees this firsthand when he takes a short trip down Massachusetts Avenue to Harvard University. Stepping out of the domain of conservative engineers and into the world of liberal theorists of the state and state policy, Chomsky feels a marked change in the level of tolerance for his radical democratic views. He described this to me in a letter. Quote, "By conventional measures, the Harvard faculty is much more liberal, in fact, left liberal. MIT faculty are very conservative, often even reactionary. I get along fine with the MIT faculty even when we disagree about everything, which is the usual case. If I show up at the Harvard Faculty Club, you can feel the chill settle. It is as if Satan himself entered the room." In this book, I want to examine the outlook of professionals where it matters the most, which is on immediate issues, that is, issues where what professionals do or say affects society directly. All workplace issues are immediate, as are a few outside of work. Thus, when I speak of professionals as uncritical and ideologically obedient, I am referring not to their opinions on distant social issues, but rather to the attitudes they display at work, where their conservatism shows up in its biggest and most socially significant way. And I am referring to their attitudes toward immediate non-workplace issues, which are issues that raise questions about the merit or strength of the larger system, questions that professionals are usually quick to play down. I don't mean to imply that all professionals are conservative when it counts. Some professionals do make trouble for the establishment. Although relatively few in number, such activist professionals help maintain an influential oppositional subculture in their workplaces, in their disciplines, and in society. This subculture provides inspiration, encouragement, and a vital safe haven for individuals whose thought deviates from the mainstream, and it gives the members the support they need to challenge their employers and others with power and to push for reform. Oppositional professionals have become increasingly influential since the 1960s, in part because of the battles fought at that time. The civil rights and anti-war movements, by successfully challenging the powers that be, helped make speech freer and the population more skeptical, conditions favorable for the opposition. However, contrary to common belief, the number of oppositional professionals has remained relatively small. Consider, for example, college professors, who are among the most left-leaning of all professionals. Today, only about 5% of the 550,000 full-time college faculty members in the United States consider themselves to be left of the conservative to liberal mainstream. This 1 in 20 proportion of leftists hasn't fluctuated much in the last 30 years. If the proportion seems higher than this, that may be because people who break away from the mainstream establish a presence way beyond their numbers, and because radicals are speaking out more openly inside and outside of the classroom. Also, in a few disciplines in the humanities, leftists may really have increased their proportions significantly, a fact that conservatives have misrepresented to make widely publicized claims that leftists have taken over higher education in the United States. The bottom line is that while the vast majority of professionals continue to share the views of corporate business executives on most basic issues, the important minority that dares to disturb the status quo has grown in influence, if not in size. For understanding the professional, the concept of ideology will emerge as much more useful than that of skill. But what is ideology exactly? Ideology is thought that justifies action, including routine day-to-day activity. It is your ideology that determines your gut reaction to something done, say, by the president. You feel it is right or wrong. By protesters, you feel it is justified or unjustified. By your boss, you feel it is fair or unfair. By a coworker, you feel it is reasonable or unreasonable, and so on. More importantly, your ideology justifies your own actions to yourself. Economics may bring you back to your employer day after day, but it is ideology that makes that activity feel like a reasonable or unreasonable way to spend your life. Work in general is becoming more and more ideological, and so is the workforce that does it. As technology has made production easier, employment has shifted from factories to offices, where work revolves around inherently ideological activities such as design, analysis, writing, accounting, marketing, and other creative tasks. Of course, ideology has been a workplace issue all along. Employers have always scrutinized the attitudes and values of the people they hire to protect themselves from unionists, radicals, and others whose bad attitude would undermine workplace discipline. Today, however, for a relatively small but rapidly growing fraction of jobs, employers will carefully assess your attitude for an additional reason, its crucial role in the work itself. On these jobs, which are in every field, from journalism and architecture to education and commercial art, your view of the world threatens to affect not only the quantity and quality of what you produce, but also the very nature of the product. These jobs require strict adherence to an assigned point of view. And so, a prerequisite for employment is the willingness and ability to exercise what I call ideological discipline. This book is about the people who get these jobs and become members of the ideological workforce, that is, professionals. My thesis is that the criteria by which individuals are deemed qualified or unqualified to become professionals involves not just technical knowledge, as is generally assumed, but also attitude. In particular, attitude toward working within an assigned political and ideological framework. I contend, for example, that all tests of technical knowledge, such as the Graduate Record Examination, GRE, or the Law School Admission Test, LSAT, are at the same time tests of attitude, and that the examination used to assess professional qualifications are no exception. I consider in detail how the neutral-looking technical question on such examinations probe the candidate's attitude. The qualifying attitude, I find, is an uncritical, subordinate one, which allows professionals to take their ideological lead from their employers and appropriately fine-tune the outlook that they bring to their work. The resulting professional is an obedient thinker, an intellectual property, whom employers can trust to experiment, theorize, innovate, and create safely within the confines of an assigned ideology. The political and intellectual timidity of today's most highly educated employees is no accident. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in 2000. Continuing with the next subheading in Chapter 1, Trusted Cadre. As attitudes and values have come to play an increasingly important role in the production of goods and services, employers have faced a choice. either hire huge numbers of managers to direct every move of the large numbers of employees who do politically sensitive work, or hire employees who can be trusted politically and merely check the results of their work. Employers have pursued both strategies simultaneously, but the first one is limited by its cost. And so today, every country in the world, from the United States to China, has a growing cadre of people trusted to do the work that requires making decisions based not on detailed instructions, but on an assigned ideology. The long episode of the Cold War drew attention to the Soviet cadre. Beginning in the late 1940s, the U.S. government beamed the Voice of America radio program directly to the people of the Soviet Union. These shortwave broadcasts were in English, Russian, and a dozen minority languages spoken in the USSR. On and off from 1948 until 1987, the Soviet government operated as many as 3,000 jamming transmitters, at a cost estimated at up to $500 million a year, to drown out these programs, except for the ones in English. Never in its 4 decades of jamming did the Soviet government censor English-language propaganda broadcasts aimed at its population. Why? Was it simply because the number of Soviet citizens who understood English was too small to worry about? That is certainly part of the answer. But it cannot be the whole story, because no group was too small for the Soviet government to worry about. English was a standard course in the Soviet schools, and at least some of the students who did well in school and were selected to become professionals eventually learned it. The number of Soviet citizens who could understand English language broadcasts may have been small, but so was the number who could understand many of the minority languages that were jammed, at least 6 of which were spoken by less than 1.5% of the population. The Soviets never censored the English language propaganda broadcasts because those who spoke English were a select group of people who were trusted to maintain ideological discipline in their work, even when they were not enthusiastic about the assigned ideology. As Robert C. Tucker, a longtime student of the Soviet Union, told me, they were more likely to be establishment people and not dangerous. Many of these people, such as journalists, academics, and foreign service professionals, were not only trusted to hear the U.S. government's viewpoint, but were also expected to know it so they could answer it and not get caught off guard by it. The Soviets apparently treated the English language broadcasts as if they were an exclusive service for their country's ideological workforce, prepping its members to handle any dangerous viewpoints that made it through the jamming and reached ordinary working people. As work has become increasingly ideological, professionals have made up a growing fraction of the workforce. In the United States in 1920, only one employed person in 20 was a professional. By 1940, this ratio had increased to 1 in 15. By 1960, it was 1 in 12. And by 1980, it had risen to 1 in 8. Today, at the beginning of the 21st century, the ratio is approaching 1 in 6 and growing rapidly. The year 2000 began with the number of professionals approaching 22 million and total employment approaching 135 million. In fact, employment in professional occupations is growing faster than that in any other major occupational group, not only in terms of percentage growth, but also in terms of people employed. This was true in the 10-year period ending in 1996, and it is expected to be true again in the period from 1996 to 2006, during which the number of professionals is projected to increase 27%, while total employment increases 14%. the U.S. workforce is splitting into haves and have-nots. Indeed, service occupations are the second fastest-growing occupational group numerically, and the third fastest in terms of percentage growth. Technicians are experiencing the second fastest percentage growth, but are a small occupational group. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, professional specialty occupations and service occupations, which are on the opposite ends of the educational attainment and earnings spectrum, are expected to provide nearly half the total job growth from 1996 to 2006. Such stratification of society has naturally heightened public interest in the people who are eligible for the high strata jobs. Witness, for example, the media attention paid to the bell curve's so-called cognitive elite and Robert Reich's symbolic analysts. Who, in more specific terms, are the professionals? In answering this question, one must be careful not to confuse professionals with white-collar workers in general, because white-collar workers who now make up over one-half of the workforce are mostly non-professionals. Chapter 2 gives a formula for identifying professionals and non-professionals by their responsibilities on the job, but a representative listing here would be useful. By any modern definition, the term professional refers to people in a wide variety of fields. The U.S. Census Bureau occupational category professional specialty workers includes such people as lawyers, teachers, counselors, social workers, registered nurses, doctors, psychologists, psychic readers, clergy people, systems analysts, software specialists, engineers, scientists, people working as intellectuals or professors, architects, designers, athletes, entertainers, actors, directors, writers, photographers, artists, musicians, radio and television interviewers, hosts, personalities, and news people, reporters, editors, censors, public relations specialists, advertising writers, librarians, political scientists, sociologists, urban planners, and economists. My use of the term professional, based on the formula in Chapter 2, turns out to be a bit broader. For example, the formula leads me to include not only those in the above-mentioned census category, but certain low-level executives as well. Here I have in mind those people who make up the new core of salaried MBAs. Holders of master's degrees in business administration, hired to fill slots in large corporations, financial institutions, advertising agencies, and so on. I also include salaried accountants and certain compliance inspectors and law enforcers. Excluded are those who are above or below professionals in the social pyramid. Thus, among those that neither the Census Bureau nor I include as professionals are, on the one hand, those who hire and fire professionals, and on the other hand, people such as the following: technicians, shopkeepers, paraprofessionals such as paralegals, teachers' aides, and medical care aides, secretaries and other clerical workers, skilled and unskilled factory, farm, construction, and transportation workers, machine operators, craftspeople, repair people, sales workers, service workers, and wage workers in general. The traditional image of the professional as an independent practicing doctor, lawyer, or clergyman is misleading, not only because of the proliferation of other professions, but also because very few professionals are free practitioners. The overwhelming majority are salaried employees. This has been true for many decades and is increasingly the case today, as even the traditionally independent doctors and lawyers are swept into the salariat. Of every 9 professionals today, 8 are salaried employees, and 1 is a free practitioner. Hence, when I use the term professional, I have salaried employees in mind. But not just those in the United States. As my use of an example from the Soviet Union was intended to suggest, the discussion here should be understood to apply to salaried professionals around the world, whether they are in the United States, Russia, or any other industrialized country, or in the developing world where each country now has a growing modern sector. Professionals go through similar training, have similar values, and most importantly, play the same role in the workplace. Perhaps the most striking evidence that professionals worldwide share the same essential features is the way they can fit right in dress, attitude, and behavior, when hired into the local offices of multinational corporations or when employed abroad. A system of production that divides its non-management workforce into two distinct components, employees trusted to follow an assigned ideology in their work and employees not trusted to do so, clearly takes ideology very seriously. In fact, this system, now nothing less than a world system, gives questions of ideology highest priority. It must do so because of its increasing vulnerability in the face of more and more politically sophisticated population. And it does so within each and every corporate or government division and at all levels of administration within these units. As a result, you cannot make sense of the system as a whole, the organization that employs you, or even your own job, not just from a simple list of the goods and services being produced. Understanding, now more than ever, means knowing the very carefully constructed ideologies that are guiding the production and that are being advanced through it. You don't have to be an activist to have a very practical need for such an understanding. Ordinary life as a wage earner, parent, student, consumer, community member, or simply resident of the nation inevitably leads to conflicts with powerful organizations, employers, schools, corporations, developers, government agencies, and so on. No one responds to every conflict by saying, "I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore." Nor does a given individual always back down. Everyone fights back, at least some of the time, and therefore needs understanding for more than its own sake. However, to work effectively to change a policy or practice of an organization, or at least to get justice for yourself, understanding the ideology you're up against is not enough. You must also understand the organization's people. First and most importantly, by understanding the role that each person is assigned to play in applying the ideology to the organization's day-to-day work. This means, in part, understanding the organization's professionals, because they are the people whom executives assign to monitor most closely the goods or services being produced and to maintain in detail the ideology that guides the production and is carried by the product. Because professionals do this important political work in virtually every institution and workplace, from manufacturing, government, and education, to the news, advertising, entertainment, and culture industries, understanding the political nature of professional work is an important part of understanding society itself. No one working or living in this society, and certainly no one working for social change, can afford to be ignorant of the political role of professionals. Furthermore, professionals are the role models of the society toward which we are heading, a society in which ideology trumps gender, race, and class origin as the biggest factor underlying the individual's success or failure. the victories of the feminist, civil rights, and union movements of the past century have moved us closer to such a society. Thus, employers, led by the big corporations, are striving to ensure the survival of their precious hierarchical system of production by making it an equal opportunity system, which means subjecting employees to ideological scrutiny without sexist, racist, or elitist discrimination. In the process, the corporations reveal what is most important to them and draw attention to the essential characteristics of the people who passed the strictest version of their scrutiny, professionals. This book aims to arm people with a sharp understanding of the role of professionals in society. Such an understanding strengthens our collective ability to cope with the social and economic system and to confront it and make changes when we feel it is necessary. It also strengthens us as individuals to handle the daily confrontations that we face, because whether we are professionals or non-professionals, we must deal with and sometimes depend upon professionals at work and elsewhere. If we are to avoid being bewildered, manipulated, or even betrayed, it is crucial that we understand the social role of professionals. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. I'm reading from Chapter 1, Timid Professionals, going on to the next subchapter heading, Hidden Curriculum. The book attempts to understand professionals in part by looking at how they're made, from selection to certification, focusing on the role of attitude in the system's decisions about who is and who isn't qualified to become a professional. In short, the book is about the politics of professional qualification and professional practice. The production of the rank-and-file physicist is the book's main example, although I use examples from many other fields as well. I look at physics of all fields because it is the one in which I myself went through professional training. Also, physics is especially revealing because of its image as pure science and because its entrance requirements appear to be completely technical and not at all political. The book challenges this apparent neutrality by describing how the system of professional qualification in physics attempts to produce obedient scientists who, as employees, will give higher priority to carrying out their assignments than to questioning them, and who, in any case, will be unprepared to second-guess the political and ideological framework that gives rise to their projects and guides their technical work. I've interviewed many professionals in a wide variety of fields, and also many people who went to professional school but did not graduate. Most of these individuals remember their bouts with the qualification system in great detail, almost as if their lives had been at stake. And they usually have some sad stories and some horror stories to tell about conflicts between personal goals and institutional goals, about mistreatment, about broken dreams, and about stressed-out fellow students who suffered mental or physical breakdowns. These stories are strikingly similar from field to field, school to school, and department to department. And yet the people who tell them usually have no idea that this is the case, and hence show none of the insight that would come from recognizing the underlying conflict that the similarity points to. What I find, and this quickly becomes clear when you probe graduates and dropouts a bit, is that the qualifying attitude, the way it is favored and the way it is measured, are very much the same across the professions. When someone describes to me what really goes on in a particular school's professional training program in psychology, law, English, history, economics, or any other field. Much of what I hear sounds exactly like professional training in physics, the field I often have in mind during such discussions. For the same reason, the reader who knows the details of professional training in any field, even one very different from physics, should find the politics of professional qualifications in physics very familiar. Serious clashes between university faculty and individual students in professional training are not unusual. As we will see in the study below, these conflicts are very revealing, and examining them may be the surest way to figure out what the university's real priorities are in professional training. The conditions occur over a wide variety of immediate issues, but most boil down to a struggle over a single underlying issue, subordination. This shouldn't come as a total surprise, because knowing that the professional's work is ideological, but ideologically subordinate to management, as one might expect to find professional training pushing students to accept an ideologically subordinate role. Indeed, the conflict students run into as they proceed through the official curriculum expose a parallel hidden curriculum of subordination. Look, for example, at what one unusually perceptive student learned from her conflicts in the graduate psychology program of a very selective, high-ranking Midwestern university. I interviewed Elizabeth by email during the summer before beginning her fourth year in graduate school, when she was about halfway to the PhD. "I was in the clinical program," Elizabeth told me. "I wanted to work in the clinical program. I wanted to work directly with people, helping them, corny as it sounds. I had a philosophy that if I could help children, I could save them lots of problems growing up, because the problems would be more difficult to treat as an adult. But the strongest reason for going into clinical was that at my undergraduate school, we were pretty much told point blank that clinical was the best, and that the only people who went into other areas of psychology were those who couldn't cut it in clinical. Well, I was a good student, and I always did well in whatever I did, so of course I wanted to go for the best. In our program, you start seeing clients during your first year, but that's not where the problem started. It really started my second year, when I had difficulties with my supervisor. I don't know how good a therapist he was, but as a supervisor, unfortunately, he was horrible. Basically, the problem was he would tell me that I was doing something wrong without telling me how to correct it, and without being specific enough for me to figure out how to correct it on my own. Sometimes he would tell me I needed not to let the clients get me off track, and sometimes he said I needed to go where the client wanted to go, but he couldn't help me figure out when. It was very confusing. Sometimes I would do exactly as he suggested in supervision. Then after the session, he would tell me it was wrong. I remember once he told me I needed to be sterner, not so sympathetic. So I was. I wasn't mean, but I challenged her, the client's, assumption instead of just accepting them. I think that was a good thing. Then he listened to the tape and asked where did the change of attitude come from. He said the session was out of character for me and criticized me for it. I couldn't do it right. I didn't know what he wanted, and when I thought he did, I still couldn't do it right. He would tell me sometimes that he didn't know exactly what was wrong, that I didn't seem to get deep enough, but he couldn't tell me what information it was he thought I should have gotten, or how to go deeper. Or the criticism was personal, such as, There's just something about you that prevents clients from feeling confidence in you. As opposed to whether it was my speech, my posture, my dress, what I said, etc. Needless to say, constant criticism without direction did a lot for my self-esteem, Rye grinned. After spending a year and a half with this supervisor and sincere, diligent attempts to improve and to ask for specifics when he didn't give them, I moved on to another supervisor. She was much better, but unfortunately by this time, I was far behind in my training, was severely depressed and lethargic, and had self-esteem so low that I was having difficulty being effective. My continued failure, note vicious cycle here, led me to doubt myself in other areas of my life. It spread from feeling like I couldn't be a clinician, to feeling like I didn't belong in grad school, to everything like feeling that I was physically unattractive and undesirable, that I was not any good at my job, that I didn't have friends and didn't deserve any. There was literally nothing in my life I felt good about. I also had some physical problems with upset stomach and such, from the depression and from not eating right, etc. I decided I couldn't resolve the situation in the clinic and left clinical. Elizabeth left the PhD program in clinical psychology with a master's degree in clinical child psychology. She switched to a PhD program in experimental psychology, a subfield oriented towards psychology research. Okay, this is Elizabeth talking again. It had taken me several months to figure out what was going on and to get up the nerve to confront my previous supervisor. And unfortunately, by that time, it was too late. Basically, in a number of ways, I didn't play the game. I disagreed with the role they wanted me to play as a therapist, which was very psychodynamic with the supervisor. I believe in a much more psychoeducational approach, and I was told that I was being too friendly, that I was supposed to be a blank screen. I felt very uncomfortable with that role and would not take it. I remember once I was seeing a student who was looking at graduate schools, and I was giving her some very practical advice about how to fill out applications and write personal statements, which she asked me for. He told me I was being too friendly with her, that I should not have given her the information, that I should have instead probed about why she was nervous about applying to grad school. Please. I also openly disagreed with my supervisor and with how the clinic as a system was run. For example, they say they value student input, yet there was a very rigid line between students and staff, staff being very condescending and blatantly ignoring comments and suggestions by students. When confronted with this, they said they had considered our comments and decided they were impractical, yet they did not tell us about this decision until we confronted them, nor would they tell us why. After talking to other students who had troubles in the clinic, I realized my situation was not unique, nor was it limited to the one supervisor. The clinic has a certain model of what their ideal therapist is. If you do not fit the model, and if you do not conform, they make life difficult. The clinic is not open to people with different orientations or perspectives on how to do therapy, though they claim to be eclectic. The meaning of eclectic is that they have supervisors from different backgrounds, but none who are truly eclectic. If your supervisor is psychodynamic, you'd better give up on any chances to include any behavioral techniques, though the next year you may be under a cognitive supervisor who would scorn the early life history you were taught to take the year before. When I say model, I do not mean theoretical orientation. It's hard to explain exactly. The best way I can think of to describe the students who fit the model student role is to call them brown nosers. I can think of other terms, but they kind of have to do with how the noses got brown in the first place. Grin. They do everything they're told with seeming enthusiasm. They boost faculty egos, checking out attitudes and beliefs before writing that paper or giving that presentation. They just kind of go along, and even perhaps go so far as to praise the system. These are, of course, the students despised by the other students who are brave enough, stupid enough, to stand up for how they feel. I know one of these students who told me it's all an act, just so she will get a traineeship or better recommendation for internships. But others, I think, really believe it. Overall, students who are most successful in the program don't rock the boat, do what they're told, and do what I'd call play the game. Perhaps my unwillingness to play led me and others to have difficulty in the program. With some teachers, not all, to be fair, independent thought is not encouraged. If you bring up opinions with or without research evidence to back it, you are at least ignored, at most ridiculed. Anyone who disagrees or who is an independent thinker is given a hard time. There are actually a lot of independent thinkers in my class. The difference with me was that I didn't think I was strong enough to stand up to the faculty who tried to conform me. So I refused to conform, but I wasn't assertive enough. So my lack of conformity appeared like lack of learning instead of a difference of opinion. I've changed quite a bit as a result of this experience. Oh, one other thing. Women who get married or, God forbid, have children are not serious about their careers, or so the thought in the department goes. This is not even subtle prejudice. Married or pregnant women are given a more difficult time with their research. After all, they're not serious about it, are they? And are openly told by some faculty that they are making a mistake. Related to this is a strong gossip network, where your personal life is cut open and scrutinized. Anyone who's smart doesn't let any of their personal life be known to faculty, and are careful about which students they tell. I have a friend who got married over Christmas break and hasn't told anyone but myself and one other person. She's afraid of the repercussions. I don't want to make it sound like a bad school. There are a lot of very good things, too, and I'm sure the problems I've mentioned are not unique to my school. In fact, based on talking with other students about their training, I feel the training here is a lot better than some programs. Then Schmidt continues. Note that as Elizabeth tries to make sense of her observations, she discovers subtle but important distinctions between ideology and ideological discipline. She witnesses the central role of ideology in professional training. The clinic is not open to people with different orientations. And so she knows that the defining characteristic of the faculty's model professional must have something to do with ideology. But she sees many ideologies at work in the clinic. And she also knows that the defining characteristics aren't just an ideology. When I say model, I do not mean theoretical orientation. It's hard to explain exactly. So she simply lists the defining characteristics, and in doing so paints a clear picture, not of a particular ideology, but of ideological discipline. The successful students are the ones who check out faculty attitudes and beliefs so they can mimic them. The ones who eagerly adopt the current clinical supervisor's outlook, no matter what it happens to be. In general, the ones who subordinate their own beliefs to an assigned ideology. I could, of course, say a lot more about Elizabeth's story, but my goal in this book is to present a framework that you can use to analyze accounts like hers for yourself.